I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal, and today our guest is George Casey, an M&A partner at Linklaters in New York. George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Very good to be with you. Very good to see you again.
So we're going to talk about your career on today's podcast, your focus on cross-border work, both during a stint in London from 2002 to 2005, and then in New York. You teach the subject at Penn, which we'll talk a little bit about, and you've done deals in a wide array of jurisdictions, and we'll get into some of that as well. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice.
Yeah, thank you, David. So this is my 30th year, actually, well, 30 years that I've been practicing. 29 of these years, I was at Chairman Sterling, now at Linklaters, a chairman of Global Corporate at Linklaters as of 6 months ago. So coming out of law school, I started at Chairman Sterling as a first-year associate. I was doing kind of a variety of work. I was doing derivatives, so I was doing structured finance, some corporate work. M&A was definitely of interest, probably because it was very varied. No deal was like any other deal. The issues that were coming up were very interesting, and you needed to really understand in depth, not just the legal aspects, but business financial aspects. So M&A really drew me into it. And so for the last 30 years, that's what I've been doing.
Was there a specific deal that really attracted you to the practice, or was it more the range of subjects? And then, of course, the cross-border nature of your work, which was very much a part of your career, you know, certainly from the time you were a young partner when you moved to London.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, what was really drawing me into M&A was the spectrum of different things that I was learning. And I was so eager to learn from poison pills. You know, you remember that in the early 90s, like almost every public company wanted to have poison pills in place. So I learned those. You know, we were learning defenses. I was learning asset deals, joint ventures, you name it. So plenty of domestic work. But as you said, you know, I was fortunate enough where early on in my career, I started doing international work, cross-border work, some early days asset carve-out deals. You know, I remember I was doing a deal representing Novartis in the carve-out. Well, first formation of Novartis when Sandoz was merging with Ciba Geigy, and then carve-outs of various assets. Then working with BASF in asset swap, actually, with the U.S. chemical company PPG. So a variety of different deals involving different jurisdictions. And so you know, it definitely led me to only like M&A more and more, and, you know, getting myself deeper and deeper. And so before I was going to London, I was actually doing quite a few cross-border deals. And so London was kind of building on it. I would say, David, also what hooked me on M&A, I remember, I think I was at the end of my second year as an associate or third year as an associate, and we were working on a deal where senior associate had to run because his wife was giving birth. And so he had to run to the hospital. The partner was tied up and our counterparty was coming to the office for negotiations. So the partner says, well, you think you can go handle it? And I'm like, sure, I'll go handle it. And so I went and I negotiated on my own in that conference room as a very, very young associate at the time. And the adrenaline that comes with it when you're there on your toes and you're trying to do this deal as a young lawyer definitely hooks you up. And after that, you keep looking for this adrenaline in deals.
So you were in London at a period where UK and European companies were importing tactics that had been developed in the US in the 80s and 90s, and often were looking to US counsel for help on how to structure those tactics in a way that would fit within the restrictions of whatever the governing law of the jurisdiction or jurisdictions was. So talk about a couple of those situations. And again, that overall trend, which was very pronounced in the first decade of this century.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, David. And I went to London in 2002 when the firm asked me to go help build our M&A practice out of London. And as you described, that was the time where I would call it US M&A technology was coming to Europe. People were embracing US way of doing deals. And so I was representing US clients doing deals in Europe. I was also representing European clients doing deals in the US. A few deals kind of stand out from that time. Some maybe first on, you know, what I mean by M&A technology. One deal we were working on, it was a US company buying a Finnish company. And so we had our Finnish counsel produce an agreement. And, you know, it was about 15 pages long. I looked at it and said, well, you know what? This is not going to fly for an international deal for US company. And so we needed to redo effectively the agreement and do it a US style agreement. But that was the approach at the time, back 20 years ago, where many deals, particularly in civil law countries in Europe, were based on 10, 15 pages, sometimes 5 pages agreements. Actually, in some countries, like in France, people would say in a public company, don't have an agreement. You just go with a tender offer and that's it, right? So those were early days of actually agreements coming into European deals, US style agreements. I think the reason for this was because the US agreements are much more defined. You have much more content in them. Many civil law jurisdictions rely on what's written in the code. And so the agreement, people view it, the agreement does not need to be that detailed. So that was one aspect. The other deal that was very interesting to me was I was defending Pechiney when Alcan, Canadian company, went hostile against Pechiney. Pechiney was a French public company, Société Anonyme. And that deal was actually fascinating in many respects, right? First of all, it's a cross-border hostile transaction. Two, how do you defend a French company where actually we did not have any tools to defend French company? And we're working with French lawyers side by side, of course. At the time, basically, you needed to be very creative to come up with solutions on how do you slow down the hostile bidder so that you can at least get to a negotiation table and negotiate the deal. So we were using actually the interplay between US securities laws and French securities laws, French securities regulations, in trying to slow down our hostile bidder. Ultimately, we got them to increase the purchase price and get them to negotiation table and get the deal done. So all in all, it was a good outcome for the shareholders. It needed a lot of creativity, which was very, very interesting for a US lawyer. And then on the back of that, I was representing Novartis when Novartis was a white knight in a transaction where Sanofi went hostile against Aventis, French to French hostile transaction. And so in that deal, you know, all the learnings from the Pechiney deal on French securities laws and tender offer rules and how that interplays with the rest, that, you know, we were using that. And frankly, technology, techniques that we use in the US to defend companies, bringing them on a Pechiney deal to defend the company, the Novartis white knight transaction in how you come as a white knight. So maybe just to add to that, a few years later, during Pechiney times, there were no tools whatsoever. A few years later, the Ministry of Finance of France was looking at how to develop French-style poison pill. And so I was fortunate to work on that, help the team that was looking at how to develop it. And, you know, ultimately, the Ministry of Finance did adopt a style of poison pills called bon de suscription, which actually at least now allows the French companies to have some tools to defend themselves.
Certainly, you know, looking at it from afar, it seems since about 2008 that there's been maybe less of that ferment in cross-border U.S. to European or intra-European M&A. How much of that is that these tactics have been pretty widely adopted within Europe and that regulatory and governmental bodies actually adapted pretty quickly?
Yeah, it was interesting to see during those days where regulations were adopting, the governmental agencies were adopting on both sides of the Atlantic. Also, what was fascinating at the time, if you remember, SEC adopted the first cross-border release. It became effective in January 2000, right? And so, and in 2008, the SEC was amending it. So it was very interesting to see how the SEC was working on it. And they were actually reaching out at the time to practitioners. I was participating in some of these meetings who are doing cross-border work, because they were looking in 2008, to your point, at how the cross-border release and the new cross-border rules, how they worked, right? And so we were meeting with the M&A desk at the SEC and helping them with their thinking on the amendment. So to your point, the regulators on both sides of the Atlantic were moving very fast to what I would call adapt to the new global world. I teach M&A, as you mentioned, at Penn, and I tell students that the world has become a global marketplace, right? And so M&A is very much a global phenomenon where you need to be a top-notch lawyer in your own jurisdiction. But to be a global lawyer, you need to be prepared to learn and keep expanding your horizons and figuring out how to deal with different regulatory regimes in different parts of the world. And so you see the conversion, actually, in different regulatory regimes, whether it's on securities law side or on foreign direct investment that we've seen over the last few years, or on the antitrust enforcement side, and so on and so forth.
And so how, as a lawyer, do you do that? I mean, obviously, you're a U.S.-trained lawyer. You're steeped in U.S. law. You were, you know, as an associate, you trained on U.S. deals. When you go into a situation where you may not have a lot of familiarity with the legal and regulatory regime, how long does it take you to learn what you need to learn? And how do you rely on, you know, say in the situation of Finland or whatever the country is, how do you rely on your co-counsel to tell you things you don't know you don't know?
Yeah. It's a fascinating question. And it's one of those most interesting things about being a, you know, I call it global lawyer, a lawyer who does work in different parts of the world. You know, in my career, again, I've been fortunate. I've done deals. I mentioned Finland, South Korea, Ghana, Chile, Peru, you name it. And obviously plenty of U.S. domestic deals. But to your question, to be conversant in how to do deals in other jurisdictions, first of all, you need to be at the top of your M&A knowledge in your own jurisdiction, because if you don't know that, it's very difficult for you to learn how deals get done in other places. Second is, I tell my students at Penn that you really need to be open-minded and not project, not expect that people in other parts of the world think the way we do in the U.S., that they will do things exactly the way we do. And, you know, trying to learn, right? And then the more you learn, the more you know about one jurisdiction, then you can start seeing patterns where the laws are maybe similar, maybe at least in some respects in other jurisdictions. So to your question on Finland, for example, you know, Finnish law, other continental European laws, so it's based on civil law, right? So having worked on French deals, you kind of understand at least how Finnish lawyers think, right? And then it's a question of how do you ask the right questions. And sometimes you need to sit down and actually go in minute detail through a list of questions on, for example, you know, what kind of approvals do you need to have in Finland, right? You go through your mental checklist so that you do not miss something, because the most experienced lawyers in the country may not necessarily think about the type of things that you would be worried about. One interesting example is actually, I mentioned the deal in Ghana. So, you know, we were representing a South African company in acquiring a Ghanaian public company. And so, your question on, you know, how do you prepare for this? So I was going to a kickoff meeting in Johannesburg before getting on the flight for a couple of days. I actually pulled up the takeover code of Ghana, the company's law of Ghana, and mining law of Ghana. And so, and was reading that, literally sitting down and reading it and, you know, trying to understand how their takeover code is structured, you know, what's in there. And takeover code at the time in Ghana was, I think, about 2.5 pages, maybe. The Companies Act was actually very detailed. It was based on the UK, on English, actually, English Companies Act. And I consciously use English as opposed to UK because it's actually the Companies Act of England and Wales, right? And so I come to the meeting in Johannesburg and we start talking about the transaction structures and we had Ghanaian counsel join us and people were talking about, you know, tender offers. And I remember reading in the Companies Act that Ghana has scheme of arrangement as a structure, which is a UK structure known in Companies Act of England and Wales, as well as in Scotland. And so I actually remember I asked in the meeting, so why wouldn't we consider a scheme of arrangement? Because it may be actually, for a number of reasons, an easier way to do this deal in Ghana. And the Ghanaian council says, well, we have it in the Companies Act, but actually there's never been a scheme of arrangement in Ghana. So fast forward, we did the very first scheme of arrangement in Ghana. There are so many other aspects of that deal that are interesting because we had to create a Ghanaian depository receipt because it was very important for Ghana to have shares listed actually in Ghana, shares of the combined company. And so we created Ghanaian depository receipts to have actually listing on Ghanaian stock exchange. So that's where you hear the passion in my voice, right? It's fascinating to do those kind of things because you feel like you are at the cutting edge. You are creative, you know, all your creative juices are flowing. And so you are coming up with all the interesting solutions and ideas, and then you actually see them implemented and getting the deal to a successful closing. So that's what's fascinating.
So you returned to the U.S. from London in 2005, and then 2005, 2006, the first half of 2007 were extraordinarily busy period in M&A. That all ends within a couple of weeks in July and August of 2007 when the debt markets freeze up. And then in the fall of 2008, you represent Dow in negotiating a joint venture with the Kuwaitis. Talk about that deal and broadly speaking, how you deal with political sensitivities in cross-border deals that may not exist at anything like that level in the average domestic deal.
Yeah, thank you, David. That's actually a very memorable time in my career. So I come back in 2005 and it was a very busy time. And you're right to point out that the financial crisis started, many people refer to it as 08, but you're absolutely right. It started actually in July, August of 07. Seven financing markets shut down and banks were not funding deals anymore. And so there were some deals pending at the time that we were rushing actually to close and we did successfully at that time. So in 2008, it was in the middle of financial crisis that we were negotiating a $17 billion joint venture between Dow Chemical and state-owned company in Kuwait. Negotiations were actually in London, where both the Dow team and we were camping out for pretty much entire summer of 2008. We signed that deal Friday after Thanksgiving, as M&A world will have it, Friday after Thanksgiving in 2008. Very, very good joint venture, going to good joint venture for Dow and would have been very good joint venture for the state of Kuwait and state-owned company. And then political turmoil in Kuwait started happening. So basically, we signed on November 28th and the closing was scheduled for January 2nd of 2009 at the start of the year, right? So we had about a month, a little bit over a month between signing and closing. About 2 weeks into it, we started hearing that there is noise in Kuwaiti media. Parliament started actually asking questions about the deal. People were agitating against the deal in the Kuwaiti parliament. And so we were starting getting nervous about this, but our counterparty, the people who worked at the Kuwaiti company, you know, they thought that the deal made a lot of sense for Kuwait. It was a great deal for Kuwait, actually. And by the way, in retrospect, looking from a number of years after that, it would have been a great deal for Kuwait. But, you know, political pressure was increasing in Kuwait. And so the Minister of Oil started getting under pressure. And then the Prime Minister's office started getting under pressure. And so just around the time as we were coming to our closing at the end of December, that pressure was increasing. And one morning I wake up, that was December 28th, to a number of emails that are saying that, well, Prime Minister of Kuwait signed an order, quote unquote, canceling the deal, right? So we quickly got the translation of that Prime Minister's decree and say, you know, he's canceling the deal and he is forbidding the company to move forward with the transaction. So we had to take the deal to arbitration, which was the dispute resolution mechanism under the agreement. And then for 3 years as a transactional lawyer, you sit on needles when your deal is under the microscope by the arbitration panel. We won and got damages in something like $2.2 or $2.5 billion in damages. And by the way, we collected those damages. So a fascinating deal, a lot of memories from that deal and the arbitration itself, which goes to the question that you posed. You know, when you do these cross-border deals, international deals, you are attuned to geopolitical dynamic and in-country dynamic, right? So understanding the political situation in Kuwait, understanding how their system works. Actually, I learned quite a bit about their parliament and how the system works, and then navigating through it. So in a way, when you are an international cross-border M&A lawyer, you need to be attuned to geopolitics all the time, right? Because in whichever part of the world you're working, you need to understand both in-country situation and the geopolitical environment in the region, how the government in that country is thinking about it, how we in the U.S. viewing a particular situation, a particular region, and so forth.
What about teaching at Penn? When did you start teaching at Penn? What is your course like? And what do you get out of it as the teacher? How does it help keep your skills sharp?
Yeah, I call it, it's for my soul, because the sense that I get from teaching, the feeling that I get from teaching, this uplifting that I actually share something with students who want to go and practice law, that frankly, in law school, when I was doing my JD, I don't think was available. The practitioners were not teaching M&A at the time. And so I call it for my soul. I really enjoy doing it and really makes me tick, so to say. So this fall, it will be my 14th year teaching it. I started in 2010 when one of the professors was going on sabbatical and asked, can I substitute for him? I said, sure. He was teaching a class at Penn. Then he comes back, says, well, actually, there's going to be a Delaware judge who's going to be substituting for me, but the school is interested in whether you can do something, quote unquote, global. I said, like what, like on cross-border M&A? He says, yeah, that actually would be interesting. Can you put together a syllabus? So I put together a syllabus, sent it, did not hear from the law school for a couple of months. Then they come back and says, the faculty voted on the syllabus, so you are in. Like, whoa, okay, so the work starts. So then the first year was a lot of work because it's a two-hour class every week. And so starting on Friday night all the way through Sunday night every week, I would spend basically, I would work nonstop in preparing for the next class based on the syllabus that I developed. So that was a lot of work. But then, you know, second year was a little better. By now, I fine-tuned the class. I think how I can improve it. But it's definitely easier now than it was 14 years ago. What's particularly interesting for me, there's a Chinese proverb that says, one is teaching, two are learning. So when you're on your toes in front of the class, and the class is the first one-third of the semester, it's heavy-duty U.S. securities laws, right? Starting with basics of securities laws and then coming to various cross-border rules and the tender offer rules and various cross-border structures and so forth. But we go into first into basics of M&A rules, right, on the securities regulations. And then there are other parts to the class. When you are there and you are explaining to the class some aspects, every year, you know, there's going to be a question and like, okay, well, that's an interesting question, right? Puts you on your toes and you need to elaborate. And also when you need to explain something so that people really learn and understand, you need to go so much deeper into the rules and why they are the way they're written, why we have the approach to tender offer rules the way we do, how it compares to French tender offer rules, how it compares to UK tender offer rules. Those are fascinating intellectual effects of teaching. And then the most fascinating thing, and that's another reason why I call it It's for My Soul, I remember one of the first classes during my first semester teaching, I was explaining something on securities laws, and one of the students asked a question, and I explain it kind of from practitioner's point of view, like how these rules work, and I can see the light bulb go off. And I'm like, wow, okay. And these are students who took securities regulations in previous year. I'm like, wow, okay, well, makes you feel really good then, this light bulb going off. So very, very interesting. But also teaching at Penn opened the doors to get to know the Penn faculty. I'll open the door to Institute for Law and Economics, where I sit on the advisory board and got to know quite a few people. There are practitioners there, faculty members of Penn there, but also Delaware judges are there. That's how I got to know Chief Justice Leo Strein, who was on the advisory board. And then he was also teaching at Penn at the time. And so he asked me to do some guest lectures for him. So it's actually a very interesting group of people who you get to know, who I probably would not have met otherwise. Well, I probably would have met them in some other settings, but not at the level where you meet people when you teach.
Talk about your move to Linklaters at the beginning of this year.
So I've known Linklaters, David, going back to probably late 90s, known in a sense of back in the late 90s, we were working on a deal. And as a young lawyer, I was fortunate enough where the partner just let me run with the deal, and the deal was very complex. So I was advising on U.S. securities laws, and Linklaters were advising on English law aspects of the deal. And so we were working side by side as co-counsel, co-advising the client. And you know, it was very, very good experience with them. Sometimes when you have co-counsel, people do not necessarily work very well together. Not my style. My style is always to work together for the benefit of the client and to deliver the best result. And so with Linklaters, it was exactly that approach. We were working very well together, really delivering the result that we needed to deliver to the client, and the deal successfully closed. I felt that I liked their culture. It was very similar to the way I look at things. And so I stayed in touch with people over many years and got to know then other teams at Linklaters. So I always had a good feeling about the firm. Over time, people were asking me, why wouldn't you come join us? And I was saying no. But then sometime, I think it was in the late summer, early fall of last year, I had another coffee with them, and they said, well, you know, we'd like to tell you about our vision, our strategy in the U.S. And when they described it to me, it was very appealing. It's a great firm with tremendous DNA in M&A. The firm is 185 years old, and it's actually historically, traditionally, an M&A firm. We have 650 M&A lawyers globally with a tremendous M&A track record and platform. And so it became very appealing to come and help bring Linklaters to the next level in the U.S. and for them to open their next chapter in the U.S. And frankly, became for me next chapter for my career as well. In the U.S., we have 200 lawyers. We have full service practice. We've seen tremendous growth, actually, even before me joining, across energy and infrastructure, tax, employment benefits. So we have all the ingredients to do deals. And so me coming in, once I did it and saw that Linklaters has everything for me and my team, and we came as a team to do high-end M&A, it kind of became a very easy proposition. And so we came in with our own work. Our clients followed us, and we've been pitching back and forth almost every week, actually sometimes several times per week, and bringing new work, winning new deals. So you may have seen that we're representing Volkswagen in the big transaction with Rivian, very cutting edge deal where we are working as an integrated US-German team. We jointly pitched for the deal and we are jointly working on it. So really great opportunity for me and a new chapter for the firm. And we are continuing growing. So we just added Shruti Chopra from Paul Weiss on the IP side, transactional IP. Yelena Narcissian came from Skadden to do real estate with us. So we're keeping growing and keeping adding to the team. And it's definitely an amazing next chapter.
So the U.S. market is certainly for corporate work, the deepest, most profitable legal market in the world, and has been for decades. And it's a market that many of the leading London firms have tried with varying degrees of success to enter since at least the 1990s. Talk about the opportunities and the challenges of this market for the London law firms.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, David. It's not an easy market for UK firms, for Magic Circle firms. And I was curious about this back when I came to London in 2002. I saw that European companies, European-based multinationals were much more receptive to hiring US firms than US clients or US-based multinationals open to Magic Circle firms. That changed over the last 20 years, but it's still not an easy market. The way I look at it is US companies have so many firms available to them in the US, right? And so having another newcomer, so to say, a Magic Circle firm as part of the offering, sometimes the company say, we'll look at it, sometimes not, right? But at the end of the day, you know, what we are seeing now is that when we show the depth of experience, level of practice that we have across the US at Linklaters and at the global platform, it resonates with clients. But it is true that for European multinationals hiring US firms, you know, was kind of and probably easier proposition. But that might go to, David, the point you made early in our conversation, that when we were bringing US technology to European markets, to other actually global markets, in Asia would be the same, in Latin America, companies were open to it. They liked US lawyers because US lawyers are proactive, US lawyers are creative. We do not just take a view that we sit down somewhere in the corner and we'll write down what other people will say. We want to participate in the discussion, have a seat at the table, and that clients like that. But I think US market has changed and changing as we see it. So we definitely see a lot of opportunities for us, for Linklaters in the US market. And we already see over the 6 months we've been here, we definitely have a very good receptivity among the our clients, existing clients, and new clients.
And then finally, talk a little bit about what you do to decompress from the job.
This is probably one of the hardest questions of the conversation, David, because decompressing for an M&A lawyer is almost anathema, but you do need to decompress. So I'll put it probably in two key categories for me. Being an M&A lawyer is, as everybody would know who does it, it's unpredictable. Life is unpredictable. Friday night, you get a call and all your plans for the weekend go away. You may plan vacation with the family and you cannot go. And so I went through it and my family has been very tolerant of it. But family is your question on decompression has been my main focus in decompression. As kids were growing up and now everybody is out of the house and on their own. As kids were growing up, I was trying to spend as much time when I had downtime with them, with their various events and supporting them in various things they were doing. And we're very close as a family and staying very close as a family, even now as the kids grown up now. So that's very, very important to me. And that's a very big part of truly decompressing and switching off your mind and going and focusing on whatever the aspect of their lives at the time may have been. The other thing is our job is very demanding and I view it as it's very important to stay fit. So over many, many years, for decades, I developed my routine where I do not skip exercise, gym, weights, aerobic exercises are very, very important to me. So on weekends, gym and strength training plus bikes or whatever it may be that the weather is allowing, I do that. That allows me to also switch off my mind because when you lift weights, you cannot really think about other things. So those are probably key things I try to do. I try to go into golf, but frankly, M&A lawyers don't have time for golf, so I never learned it. So that would not count as decompression, although I try from time to time to come out.
George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, David. Really enjoyed the conversation. It was great to see you again and looking forward to seeing you again soon.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.